So here's the paradox. If you are an Ethiopian spy today, you are very likely to have been trained by the Americans to use software produced in Europe and to harvest data in a Chinese network. So these complexities are what I want to bring to the fore.
Hello and welcome to the African Tech Roundup, episode 132. This is where we round up the most important tech, digital, and innovation highlights from across the African continent. My name is Andile Masugu. Glad you could join us. And this episode is brought to you in association with our friends at Business Live and, of course, the team at Multimedia Live. Thanks to them, the African Tech Roundup podcast is now available on Business Live and wherever you stream Multimedia Live podcasts. So we're really, really grateful for that. And listen, if you're into wrapping your mind around the growing relationship between Africa and China, boy, are you in for a treat today, because we're dedicating this entire episode of the show to understanding, or at least starting to better appreciate, how various key markets in Africa and the continent at large are responding to, or even in some cases actively encouraging, Chinese commercial participation within the tech and innovation sector. But before we get to all that, please allow me to welcome back to the show a man who is somewhat of an oracle, because when he joined me on our last flagship episode, he declared that he hoped that it would be the first of many. I'm speaking of none other than Osarumen Osamui, joining us via Skype from Abuja. How are you doing, man?
How are you doing, Andile? I'm all right.
Good, good. I'm doing really, really well. I believe it's your mum's birthday out there.
60th birthday.
Oh, my word. I hope you're making her feel special.
In fact, I am.
You better be that boy. You better be that boy. Please give her our best. And listen, people are telling me that, one, the tenor of your voice is a thing of beauty. This is what I'm hearing from the streets.
Interesting.
Yes, the village is speaking. Secondly, they also say your mind is a wonder. Your mind is a wonder, brother. So believe me, I am not alone in admiring your talent for nuanced analysis, and it's a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us, man.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for your kind words.
Absolutely. Now, joining us via Skype from the University of the Witwatersrand, aka Wits University, where the man's launching a book. Well, we have an extra special guest who knows a thing or two about the evolving Africa-China relationship, particularly as it pertains to matters of tech and innovation. Welcome to you, Eugenio Gagliardone.
Thank you, Ndile. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. As you know, I've been a heavy listener, and so it's great to be on it.
Thanks for being a member of the village, even before you jumped on the mic. Listen, Eugenio teaches media and communication at the University of the Witwatersrand at Wits University in South Africa. He is also an associate research fellow in new media and human rights in the program in comparative media law and policy at the University of Oxford. And as I alluded to earlier, he's also the author of a book that's just been published, and one that Osarumen and myself have only just started to read. It's called China, Africa, and the Future of the Internet. Good, strong title. It's published by Zed Books. Congrats on the book, Eugenio. You are currently in the throes of launching the book, taking it to the people. Sounds good?
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was the first time that I signed a book. I was a bit embarrassed. But it was such a nice crowd of people. I couldn't imagine a better bunch for my first experience with a pen on my own book.
Congratulations, Eugenio.
Thank you.
Osarumen, we're observing the transition from man of the people to celebrity right before our eyes.
Yes, we are.
I'm yet to sign my first autograph. So, Eugenio, you have
me too.
You have that on me. Perhaps, Osarumen, you had the pleasure, not me.
I haven't, not yet.
Oh,
but soon.
All right, so thank you for bringing those celebrity vibes to the show, Eugenio. You launched the book at an investigative journalism conference, is that right?
Yeah, it was a great conference. It was not just on China, Africa, and journalists from across the continent trying to think the way through into the very complicated future of investigative journalists on the continent. Very cool people here.
Are you finding people willing to engage with some of the complex notions that you highlight in your book?
The thing that I noticed is that people do appreciate the complexity. It's not the one-way story. There is a lot of layers when we talk about Africa and China, and we take it to the global level and engage with other actors. But there is a challenge. So where is the space to tell this kind of complexity? If you are a journalist, you don't have 200 pages to explain what the relationship is, or you don't have 10 years to do work. But I think there are some lessons that can be learned and also used into this space. And it was quite rewarding also receiving some emails from people, for example, in the US saying, well, we were using kind of a simplistic narrative, but going through the book and I'm not the only one who's been writing about these things and start appreciating that things are much more complicated than we usually write.
Oh, we love to hear that on this show, because, of course, we go by oversimplification is the enemy. And also, Ruman and I are only a short way into the book, but already it sparked some curiosities that should make for a very lively conversation indeed. So, you know, in the acknowledgement section of the book, you share an anecdote of how being lost in a building in Ethiopia after a high profile interview led to an interesting discovery. Perhaps by way of introducing yourself a little further and letting us into how you've become what I consider a leading thinker in the Africa-China tech space. Tell us who you were meeting and what you happened upon.
Well, that was like more than 10 years ago. It was 2008. I was working on a previous book. The book was looking at the role of media in nation building in Ethiopia. Very interesting, very complex country. And I was very lucky. I was really happy because I had the chance to meet the CEO of what at the time was Ethiopian Telecommunication Corporation. It was a great meeting. It went well beyond what I was expecting. It was just, I think we spoke for 2 hours. And I was happy when we were done. I was exhausted. And as you do when you meet people who are important, you have just clear my agenda. And then I just start wandering on the top floor of the building. A few doors were open, and I sort of, was peeking in and trying not to be too inquisitive. And what I noticed is that in the room, there were not Ethiopian computer scientists or engineers. Most of the rooms were staffed with Chinese. And I thought, well, I'm not a journalist, but there is a very interesting story to tell.
A floor full of Chinese at the top of what was then
and EDC.
Remains what the largest telco in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
The only telco in Ethiopia.
Okay. Indeed, yes. Thanks, Professor Ruman, for reminding me. It's effectively a monopoly. To have a floor full of people from the Far East working away at something says at least something about the way things would go in the years subsequent to that occurrence. So we're going to dive into what some of those things might be, and certainly some of what those things are based on the research you've been doing, Eugenio. But before we launch into the topic of the day, I thought we might start light. I'd start by asking both of you, and I'll factor in too, what your favorite Chinese thing of the moment is right now, your favorite Chinese thing.
Definitely, I have a straight answer on that one. And my very favorite Chinese things right now is The Wandering Heart. Is a blockbuster, very heavily funded science fiction Chinese movie based on a very popular novel by Liu Cixin. And if you haven't watched it, it's really worth. It's both like Armageddon type of style, but in Chinese flavors, and you're both gonna get into it, but also laugh about it. So if you haven't watched it before, that's definitely my favorite one.
The Wandering Heart, fantastic, and we're gonna share links to that so people can check it out as well. What are you into right now, Suraman?
My favorite Chinese thing at the moment, I think, is WeChat. Because the world has suddenly gotten obsessed with super apps, and I have been trying to understand them, and WeChat has been a useful tool for trying to understand the broader trend.
The super app trend is definitely something you've written a lot about, so I'm kind of not surprised. But are you an active user of the app?
I haven't been to China yet, there's not too much use. So all my use is for taking screenshots, studying its architecture, etc. Nothing too heavy.
Right,
I have no friends who use WeChat, so I can't text anybody on there. But it's useful to play around with it.
My favorite thing is a not so Chinese thing. It's actually the first full length documentary that I almost said Osama bin Laden, Barack Obama and his wife.
Watch
Michelle.
Out. The right wing people are going to build it and spin it out on the net.
No, no. Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle, have executive produced a documentary called American Factory, which is a fascinating look at a former GM plant that was taken over by a Chinese company It's available on Netflix. Fascinating. Fascinating beyond, at least to someone like me, who's just, you know, I'm a people observer, and watching, you know, Americans deal with the reality of not keeping up with the world, and then watching sort of Chinese foreign interests come in and essentially hire them to work for them. It was just a fascinating look, and perhaps even a metaphor for what's going on elsewhere in the world, even right here on the continent. As a close second to that would be my Android phone, the Pocophone by Xiaomi. It's my first Android device since saying goodbye to the iOS standard. And I have to say, it's easily the best phone I've ever owned, except for the
iPhone.
No, iPhones included, believe it or not. To be fair, I've never owned a high-end iPhone. So I've never had like the best possible experience iPhone can deliver. So I've never sort of actively experienced that on a day-to-day. But my only thing is something I've said on the show before. There has been a ridiculous erosion in my personal data privacy since reverting back to Android. That's really, really unfortunate. Except for that, I'm really, really happy with the phone. The price point was amazing. Day-to-day, the utility is incredible. So yeah, shout out to you, Xiaomi, the Apple of China.
I think the Apple of China is Apple.
Oh, shots fired. I have to agree with you. Perhaps in many respects, not least brand recognition and brand equity, Apple is still Apple, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
All right, then, gents, let's jump into the topic of the day. You know, I just want to start by saying this will not be an exhaustive summary of all you need to know, you know, as pertains to the African continent corporately or certain markets specifically, and their relationship with China vis-a-vis sort of tech and innovation. That's impossible. It's in part why in the coming months, we've decided to partner with the China-Africa project on a regular podcast offering that will study that specific topic. And so, I mean, that's just an admission of how long it'll take and just how nuanced the discussion it'll be. But I do think what Eugenio, you bring to the table is a great tablecloth on which we can put everything else and put everything else in proper context. I think the research you've done, the people you've had the privilege of rubbing shoulders with in China and on the continent will provide quite a bit of insight for us as we try and wrap our minds around what indeed the deal is in terms of Africa-China and China-Africa. And in fact, that's where I want us to start. If we think about Africa corporately for a second, in which direction is this conversation around tech and innovation involvement in Africa and in China weighted? Is it weighted on the China side, or is it weighted on the Africa side? Do we have an Africa-China dynamic or a China-Africa dynamic?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think it really depends on where we pitch our analysis. So a lot of the narrative coming, well, I would say mostly from the global north, but also in some cases in Africa, sort of frames the relationship as a China-Africa rather than Africa-China. But when I started doing my research, I also wanted to respond with empirical evidence. I think the main value added of the book is that I build it based on like principled arguments or like fancy rankings coming out from Freedom House or the like. I sat down and spoke with the many people involved in this kind of space, talking about African computer scientists and engineers and politicians and Chinese and also people from all over the world that happen to be working on the continent. I wanted also to respond to some of the claims that, well, China, when it comes to the media, has a pretty authoritarian grip of what can be said or what can't be said. And the kind of like sloppy and easy argument, a narrative that was being put forward, is more engagement of China in Africa into the telecommunication space is going to lead to more authoritarianism. So I said, okay, let's take some of these, even if I disagree with this view, let's take some of them at face value. So I selected two countries that can be flagged as authoritarian or semi-authoritarian. One is Ethiopia, the other one is Rwanda. And the other two countries are recognized as more open and democratic are Kenya and Ghana. So the question is, more engagement with China will move all these countries toward more authoritarianism? Or does China like to play and engage more with other authoritarian regimes or not?
What did you find?
And I found a lot of diversity. You know, China doesn't have a template for the continent, definitely when it comes to information and telecommunication. So let's get the case for Ethiopia. And as we just said, Ethiopia still has a monopoly over telecommunication. But it has a very strong commitment towards expanding access. So this project, this very stubborn project of maintaining monopoly and expanding access, would have been impossible without a large lender like China. So China gave to Ethiopia over 10 years the largest loan in the history of telecommunication in Africa, more than $3 billion. And with these, Ethio Telecom first, it was called ETC first, and then Ethio Telecom managed to achieve some level of this project. But then we moved to Ghana and Kenya, where the telecommunication had been liberalized very early on, and the Chinese ZTE and Huawei, the two big players, came as kind of late into the game, and so they just fit into the system that they found in these countries, and with the Safaricom, with the MTN, with the Vodacom, and they became one of the many players into this space. But we can't really see the effect that was highlighted and expected at the very beginning of this kind of engagement. So the answer is a lot of diversity.
This idea of China as water, or as something that is formless and that conforms to whatever local conditions it finds, is compelling to me. But I'm struggling to juxtapose this against a different view of China, one which history has certainly borne out, which does things in its own long-term interests, which takes a much longer time horizon than anybody else, and tries to move chess pieces to cause its interest to get advanced. One example that comes to mind is the French newspaper Le Monde, which reported that while the Chinese gifted the AU building to the African Union, they also inserted a backdoor that allowed it to transfer data, effectively bugging the place. Like that, it seems to me like China primarily acts in China's interests. So how do you square that idea against this one that you just articulated?
No, you're very right. And an interesting thing that I noticed, and I also captured in the book, is when I was speaking with, let's say, a minister of telecommunication or someone trying to develop his own startup in Kenya and so forth, there was a kind of clear and complex understanding of what China was doing at that particular point in time. But what I also saw is there was this kind of curiosity about, is there a long-term plan? Is there a kind of a master plan that we can't really see, but someone in China is sort of devising? And I want to give you an example. Again, going back to the idea that more Chinese engagement means more authoritarianism, we did see in the past few years, and you guys have been talking about it as well, a kind of more authoritarian approach by governments towards the internet. Before shutting down the internet was seen as a kind of like impossibility, and now it's becoming relatively common. Let's think about Cameroon, Ethiopia itself, and so forth. And nobody can really say that these kind of measures are motivated by trying to follow China into their own idea of the internet. But when heads of state, the late Meles Zenawi or Yoweri Museveni or Paul Biya are going on record, they say, well, we're going to do it because, you know, we don't like destabilization. And they very much tie into this is a US-led idea of we need to securitize this space. And it builds on the anti-terrorism after 9/11 and so many other things. So the paradox is when the internet is being shut down, the rhetoric that is being used in the public is the one coming from the United States first and foremost, but a large coalition of countries. But then when things are done in practice, it might be done through Chinese means. So we kind of have this unholy alliance between discourses coming from one part of the world and technology coming from another one.
Why does China get singled out when it seems pretty obvious to me that any quote-unquote global superpower at the moment is keen on shaping the world into its own image, whether we're talking the US, the global north in general, Europe certainly, Russia, and even other, you know, smaller players like Japan? Everyone's doing stuff either directly, geopolitically, or by proxy through commercial means.
My guess would be that it's because lots of the bits of media that we consume, lots of the culture that we consume and reproduce is primarily Western or primarily from the US. And so we're the version of history or the version of or our picture about what the world looks like today is very informed by America's perspective. I personally think it's unfortunate that that's the case. Because this world is much more complex than these simple narratives. But that is that's my sense for what's happening.
I also think it's kind of naive to assume that, China or anybody really could apply a continental template to our continent and how to deal with it. I mean, after all, like, would that be a Nigeria-shaped template? Would that be a South Africa-shaped template, a Zimbabwe-shaped template? Who in their right mind would approach the African continent like that? But that's a simplified narrative out there. So-and-so is winning in the race for Africa. And it's really is kind of weird. Yes, the lapse in accent, not intended there, folks. So now there's a photograph that went viral, some months back, an image of, I think it was a delegation of Zimbabwean politicians. It could have been some other African country, but I think it was Zimbabwean politicians sitting across the table from Asian counterparts. Could have been China, could have been Japan. I can't quite remember, but it's quite clearly Africa meets the East, a situation. And in front of the Asian delegation on the desk in front of them, on the table in front of them, is all these notes and, you know, laptops and tablets. And in front of the African delegation is precious nothing. folded hands, just wonderfully tidy in front of them. And as a metaphor for how a lot of people perceive the Africa-China relationship or the Africa-East relationship, but Africa-China specifically for the purpose of this discussion, to what extent does that picture reflect reality, Eugenio?
Well, I would like to add another actor to this picture, especially when we talk about the internet, we talk about digital media and related stuff. So for the book, I also had the chance to interview a number of African computer scientists and activists and people who have been part for a very, very long time of these global gathering on internet governance, where all kind of different diplomats and tech people meet and trying to define what is the present and the future of the internet. And this space had been historically dominated for obvious reason by the United States because of the, you know, what the internet is and where it comes from. And it was really interesting to hear one of these activists and civil society member saying that it had become almost embarrassing to see which kind of delegation the United States had been sending in the past few years to this gathering. And he was so impressed by the quality of the delegation sent by China, both a very great mix of the best diplomat and the best tech people. So it was also like referring to the African delegation and trying to make up their minds. So definitely they weren't sleeping. Definitely they had their laptops open or more and so forth. China is definitely stepping up the game and also with the, you know, what used to be the big power. So when it comes to the internet, they're really putting a lot of efforts into this space and it's definitely something to watch.
Do you think that dynamic that Eugenio just unpacked is indicative of essentially the centers of power or the centers of influence around those matters filtering much higher up to like offices of the presidencies or things of that nature?
Yes, that definitely resonates with me.
I want to bring up what's, to me, clearly a hint at your personal bias as an academic, as a human being. We obviously all lean into certain sort of doctrines or ideas about ourselves and the world and how it should be. My sense is that, you know, even in your framing of the idea of authoritarianism and democracy, you probably walked into the writing of this book and into your research with ideas of how you'd like to see things turn out. With that benefit of hindsight and the perspective you've gained through putting this book together and all the people you've spoken to, what would you say is your standpoint ideologically on what should be?
Well, I think I have a few, and I think they are becoming more clear as things develop. So let me start with the beginning. You know, obviously when you call things authoritarian and democratic, you are biased. But my attempt was to speak to everyone, also to speak to the critics that take this kind of definition for granted. So when you have to just engage with an adversary, you can't just do it setting a completely different rule book. You have to accept that rule book. So that's where I was starting. And I wanted to bring empirical evidence to the fore. So I was sort of like tired of logics based not on having been in particular places, but just expecting what China would do, given the idea that we have about China as well as Africa. And so some people, maybe at the beginning of my book, you know, I'm Italian, I live in South Africa, I used to live in the UK. I don't know where I, you know, where my affiliation lies right now. I'm quite confused myself. But some people would say, well, you're very much defending China's position. And probably I was doing a bit of this because I felt that there was such a strong fire on China at the time. It was just clouding our understanding and the ability to really grasp what was going on. Let me just give you an example. You know, when we briefly discussed it before, when it comes to China, the idea is, you know, the surveillance apparatus that has been built by the Chinese government in China is so sophisticated, and more China in Ethiopia or in Kenya or in Ghana, and you can add to the list, will mean greater surveillance. But if we focus on Ethiopia, the picture is so much more complicated than that. Because of the Snowden revelation, now we know that the National Security Agency, the US National Security Agency, set up a project in Ethiopia called the Lion's Pride already back in 2002. And this project was aimed at training Ethiopian spies to spy online what the Ethiopians were doing, but also like in the very hot Horn of Africa region. And because of great work that is done by colleagues in Canada, the Citizen Lab, we know that the Ethiopian government has been buying software in Europe. One company is Gamma Technology. The other one is the Italian, my own guy's hacking team, to actually get into diaspora politicians into their computers. And we discussed how China, ZTE and Huawei have been instrumental in expanding access to telecommunication in Ethiopia. So here's the paradox. If you are an Ethiopian spy today, you are very likely to have been trained by the Americans to use software produced in Europe and to harvest data on a Chinese network. So these complexities, wow, is what I want to bring to the fore and saying, are we concerned about pointing fingers? In that case, China is a very easy target. Or what we're interested in is understanding what is a bearable level of surveillance. And what can we say it's fine because of our national security and what it's not fine? And if we ask this question, the players are not just China. They are so many more. And this hypocrisy has to be unpacked.
And so, Ruben, I was just thinking, there's something about the odd mix or the uneasy mix of capitalism and democracy that's embodied in companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon that I think is not as easy a sell on the African continent in many places as it might have been perhaps, you know, 10 years ago. Why do you think that is?
I think that is because people don't care about democracy or capitalism or any specific ideology. They care about them to the extent that they are vehicles for prosperity. And so, you know, as you will see in a number of African countries today, the countries have had democracy foisted upon them. Whereas in other more developed countries, they had a bit more time. You'll find that the results have not quite been the same. And so, you know, from the perspective of an individual person in one African country, you know, you're telling him about quote unquote freedom, or you're telling him about capitalism as a vehicle for prosperity. If they haven't seen that to be true, obviously that's not going to resonate very strongly with them. Also, you know, thinking about or speaking about capitalism specifically, while I'm very much pro-capitalist, there's also a strong understanding, I have a bias, in the other direction as well, given that I believe that, a healthy mix of both a more capitalist, more individualistic society, as well as a more Marxist society is probably a good sweet spot. I don't think any one of them is, correct.
I'm 41 now, and then I was one of those people who got the internet into his own house. And meaning like, you know, I bought a package and I connected the thing, my computer, and I was so excited to hear this crackling noise of the modem and being in that space. And the internet at the time, we're talking late 1990s, was this just wonderful cyberspace where we could be whatever we wanted and we could just innovate without, with just the sky is our ceiling. And what I'm seeing today, you referred earlier to the big corporate giants. On the one end, we have China that is supporting the state. On the other hand, we have like the Facebook, the Google and the like that are like making a lot of values in any country where they work, but the values doesn't stay in the country. The value gets siphoned away and taken elsewhere. So my bias is very much, I really like that kind of vision. I really like that kind of imagery of a free open internet. And for a while, in order to apply that idea, I had to side with the United States. Now we are in a position that is both terrifying, but also really empowering if we look at it the other way, is that like there are no good guys anymore. You know, China is doing what it's doing and Facebook is doing what it's doing. And we know in the past couple of years and we can add to the list. And where is this idea of the internet? Where is it? There's still a space for the little guys or people like us to sort of shape something radically new. And this is what I think could be a new battle. And there's problem of capacity. There is problem of who is going to do that bit. But at least it would be great if we can start talking about it.
I mean, also, Ruman, this sounds to me like the formation of a sort of neo third world psyche. And I obviously, you know, I say that carefully because I don't mean this in ideological terms. I mean, perhaps we underplay the agency of African countries to pick and choose policy and partnerships in a way that, you know, is unprecedented.
As Eugenie was speaking just now, I was just thinking about some research that I did into the transportation industry in the past year, how many African governments, after the countries gained independence, tried to exert control over the transportation sector, you know, in a bid to say, you know, we are able to do this. And the paternalistic tone with which I've heard some African leaders speak about their citizens, you know, not least mine. I see lots of resonance between, you know, this top-down philosophy that seems to govern African governance and, say, the Chinese model. Whereas when many of us, again, people like myself, most of the media we consume is primarily Western. Most of the things we aspire to, most of the products we use. There's an interesting tension there that I sense that I'm still trying to work through in my head.
I recall when President Museveni in Uganda decided to switch off the internet, claiming he was doing it to keep his country safe and to maintain sort of the national interests of his citizens. And then following that, he later started, you know, to tax Ugandans for the use of social media. And it occurred to me there that there's a sort of pragmatic decision being made on the basis of some of the things that you're saying here, that, you know, I can't control what Facebook, Twitter, WeChat, WhatsApp are doing in my country. There's clear, like, commercial, you know, value being created here. It's certainly not benefiting my, you know, the citizens of, say, Uganda in the way I'd like to see it do. And, you know, I also see contracts being signed with, you know, the Pentagon. And in the admission that Twitter is making, of course, this admission wasn't made then, but I'm just, you know, I'm mashing things up now. And the admission Twitter's recently made, or their decision to not let political parties buy influence on their platform, the admission is basically, yes, our platforms can and will be used by the most powerful people in ways that serve them. And so in that context, can you blame a leader like Museveni for going, well, I want in on this action, and I want my citizens to benefit, and I'm really playing devil's advocate here, but what do you make of that reasoning, Osa Ruman?
I think you're being much, much too charitable to Museveni. it's my impression that the social media tax was primarily aimed at capturing value from the system and not rooted in any robust framework. But more broadly, to speak to something that Eugenio mentioned, I think decentralization optimizes for value creation, and centralization is great for capturing it. So, you know, in the quote-unquote open web, where there were not as many, there was not as much centralization. You know, we saw that there was lots of value being created, but to create any commercial entities or to extract any commercial value so that that creation is sustainable, centralization needs to happen. So Google needs to exist. Facebook needs to exist. All the different app stores need to exist. All the different spaces where people then congregate, make it easy for value to get extracted from the system. You know, if we go back to the open web that Eugenio was describing, there was lots of value being created at the time. It felt very idealistic or very idyllic. But for us, for anybody to extract commercial value to keep the system running and, you know, to profit for the time they've invested, we need the Googles of this world to exist. We need the Facebooks. We need the different app stores that centralize or that act as a choke point through which value can be extracted. And so Museveni, so I believe, saw a similar choke point, being again that he's the president of Uganda, and decided to extract value without the contribution that needs to come with that. So I don't think this was rooted in any, I don't think this was a resistance in any way that would be admirable. I think it was value destructive, and it was actively hurtful to the consumer. If you wanted to have a conversation about, say, bringing the Facebooks and Googles of this world to the table, then that's a conversation you should have with them and not impose a tax on the consumers who haven't done anything.
Well, to be fair to him, Mark Zuckerberg has clearly said he's not going to be flying around the world meeting with governments that beckon him to answer to what his company is or isn't doing there. But I chose Museveni intentionally because I realized just how polarizing he is as a leader. And I have to admit there are worrying aspects of his leadership style and a lot of what's clearly at this point signs that perhaps, you know, something new might be, not such a bad idea for Uganda, right? But I suppose it plays into the point that Eugenio is making, that there are no good guys. I think that's the oversimplification, that there's a self-interest at play within this techno-political space, which is a word I'm borrowing straight from your book, Eugenio. But there's definitely a self-interestedness to the way everyone from governments to large enterprise, even to how citizenry, given how more involved we are than ever before in sort of shaping the internet. There's definitely a self-interest in how all of us are going about doing what we do. And also, I mean, you have to admit, whether he realized he was being forward-thinking or not, Museveni preempted Europe's decision to start contemplating taxing Facebook and other social media platforms in their countries. And I suppose whether he designed it or not, it is setting us up for this debate about beneficiation, where it occurs and who ultimately benefits and where it all goes once, you know, once value's been captured.
I think we are all trying to stress as a very similar point. I think the assertiveness is really important. The fact that Museveni was the one who asserted it, that's a problem. And it would be great to see a bit more assertiveness coming from a civil society organization and who had very vocal in the 90s and noughts. And now they seem to have kept a little bit quiet. Or if they're not quiet, they are deciding to side with one party or another. And I think there is a very interesting conversation that can happen there of like what is legitimate or not and like how value can be created through decentralization. And it's not shutting down Facebook. It's not shutting down Google. These big players are there to stay at least for a while. Something new can be created. And, you know, Barnes, we are trying to do that.
Is it a matter of pulling an Edward Snowden, though, I wonder? Because if we're talking, you know, which side are you on, he'll argue that he's on the side of humanity. And this great imaginary that he sort of bought into as a youth and one that he's, I suppose, mourning the loss of, but not entirely giving up on. And to some extent, I hear some of those themes in your personal rhetoric. And so maybe as a way of segueing into the discussion around the imaginary of internet security or data privacy within the context of security and, I suppose, national interests, on a scale of 1 to 10, if 10 is Snowden, like, what are you? Eugenio and Osaruman, what are you?
Well, you set me up with a very difficult one. You know, I don't think, you know, if my ideas are moderately radical, I don't think that anybody's going to come and lock me up.
Well, check your windows now. There could be a Mission Impossible mission on its way.
and so forth. I will let you guys decide how radical it is. But I'm also fully aware that the Snowden and alike, they are people that I very much admire. But at the same time, what they're trying to do, it's can be captured very easily. So my book is called China, Africa, and the Future of the Internet. It's a book about the, let's call it the geopolitics of the Internet. But I'm fully aware that talking about the Internet in geopolitical terms is a problem. Because even if I don't take sides, I recognize that side exists. So let's take the example of Snowden. You know, Snowden, I flew to China like a few weeks after the Snowden revelation. And the Chinese, I'm talking about academics, I didn't meet any politicians at the time, were so excited because it was like, finally, you see, you know, we told you guys, we are not that bad. And the hypocrisy coming from the United States, it's finally visible to everyone. And Snowden was so easily appropriated by China just to point finger again. And where is Snowden now? Is in Russia. And we can do similar when it comes to WikiLeaks. We can make similar argument. WikiLeaks is these very powerful but very plain points, like whatever is in the public interest. So it was criticized a lot, like putting lives in danger because names of spies were revealed and these people could lose their life because of that. And we have also seen during the 2016 election in the United States how some of the evidence on Hillary Clinton that was made available by WikiLeaks and was used to support the election of Donald Trump. So that kind of simplistic, like, we should tell the truth to come through and people will just make use of it, I do understand it. It's too basic. And we have to rebuild. You talked about the third word of the internet. We have to build a kind of like, I go back to like the non-alignment movement, you know, a non-aligned space where some people commit to certain values and build on these values without being either in these cases, not Russia, it's going to be China or the United States. You know, it would be nice to have some Julius Nyerere and Kwame Nkrumah around. Unfortunately, it's difficult to find leaders of that value today, but that could be very powerful, I think.
Yeah, I think there's also a tendency to hero worship within the space. And mm-hmm. I think it actually, in the greater scheme of things, serves to damage some of the values that we'd like to see espoused, you know. So this idea that, you know, Edward Snowden, good. Who's the WikiLeaks guy again, by the way?
Julian Assange.
Yeah, less than fully integrous, I think it's fair to say. I don't want to make a judgment call in any direction, but I'd sooner stand behind Edward Snowden as a human being than I would Assange, given the little I know about them. And maybe that's also part of the problem, our willingness or desire to put people on a pedestal to be representative of a movement that should be really all about us. And so anyway, that aside, you didn't pick a number, so I'm picking one for you. I'm giving you a good solid 7 on that, on the Edward Snowden scale. Maybe let's call it 6. Let's call it 6 because, like you point out,
if you say 7, I will start hearing some knocking at the door.
You'll start to get visitors. Window, I wouldn't want to do that to you.
Let's agree on 6. So I can keep writing books.
Yes, also just because you're sufficiently pragmatic, but I think you stop short of being radical, which I don't know that has ever been a good thing necessarily for its own sake. And so let's call you a good solid 6. Also, Ruman, what are you?
I agree with lots of what Eugenio has said, so I think I'm a 6 as well. I tend to think about this in terms of trade-offs. One question that was crossing my mind just now is, like, to what extent should a state or should we relinquish privacy to a state for the sake of security? And today, when I juxtapose this worldview against some of the ways we talk about privacy or security, there's a bit of dissonance there.
This is often the context China or the Africa-China relationship or the China-Africa relationship is referenced. Even on the continent. They're just here to keep us safe or to help us defend ourselves in this wild, wild west that is the fourth industrial revolution. Or they're here to compromise your security and pillage the data integrity of your continent, you know, work with us, you know, and they can go any way. And often at the center of that debate is the idea of data privacy. Our apparent failure to grasp just how important and valuable our data is as Africans and what it is about it that's worth keeping secure. So, Eugenio, how does security, data privacy. How have these themes been woven into your book? And perhaps what has your experience been as you've been doing your research?
Going through the voices of the people I'd interviewed, and there is very much of a disconnect. So there is a tendency of those in power to overclaim the importance of security. And the other sense, the ordinary people working on the tech sides being very concerned and saying, I don't think these kind of laws that are being passed are justified by the real risk that...
Eugenio, can I interrupt you and press you to give me an example of how... of what arguments are often made? What are the issues that play into that argument? What are we trying to keep secure?
There, if you go to Ethiopia, the very basic one is we need to maintain our stability. And Ethiopia has been growing double digit for 10 years. We can't allow insecurity and destabilization to get into our way. So if there are dissenting voices, these dissenting voices are exaggerated in many cases. Well, maybe not this prime minister, but the previous one, we're just flagging them as terrorists. So they were flagging bloggers saying we should do something a bit different. That were acting as terrorists. And it was this rhetoric, again, they were disconnected by saying, you're agents of the West. So there was a kind of these paradoxical arguments. I don't know how they kept it together, but that was very much what they were pushing for. And on the other sense, there is this idea that, if we need to grow from our own information society, we are vulnerable, and so we have to protect from cyber attacks and the like. We have seen the United States and been the prey of some very simplistic narratives. We're not talking stealing your credit card, but building on people's credulity. And there was a fascinating piece of research coming out from Macedonia, looking how some teenagers were sort of using social media to sway elections in ways that I was so surprising. How the hell did these people know about the politics of the United States? So there is so many vulnerabilities out there. And how can you block them? I think there is really no need to just press the security issues so hard. When it comes to privacy, I think it's a little bit different. And there is a movement that it's coming and it's getting some strength, probably not enough, and saying, I produce data by my everyday interaction. The data I produce are very valuable to the companies owning the platform on which I'm writing. I own that data and I want to have control of it. The problem is, I'm teaching undergrad and postgrad here at WITS, and we talk about this stuff all the time. A lot of these young mind see these as just too complicated. Why I have to worry about it? Who am I? Why are they going to come after me? I'm an ordinary folk. So it's okay at the end of the day. It's just too much work.
There's extreme views again that view the open internet ideal as this moral imperative, and mm-hmm. that anything bad that occurs as a result should be a tax that society is able and willing to absorb.
The argument when it comes to privacy, and the argument that was very much spinned by the Google, I remember this argument made very powerfully by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO. It was if you have nothing to hide, what do you worry about it? But Cambridge Analytica has changed all that. Now we know that the way in which Cambridge Analytica worked was not just targeting everyone when it comes to the Brexit referendum, when it comes to the US election. Because of the data they had available, because of users ordinary being themselves on the internet, they targeted those that they thought were undecided. So if I was a very radical leftist or a very radical right wing, whatever, and I was likely not to be their target or to receive a lot of political out or whatever. But if I was in the middle, if I had clicked one day to Barack Obama, the next day to Hillary Clinton, and then maybe a kind of not too radical Republican, that made me a target. And at that point, I was bombarded by all sort of information mixing false news or something relatively critical, something probably truthful. And this gives a completely different understanding of privacy. So it's not like if I do something wrong, I become a target. If I just myself on the internet, who I am gets sold to someone who is going to manipulate that with results very big in the political domain. So this is a completely different idea of privacy. And to tie it to Africa and to the continent, one of the things, it was this fantastic, if you haven't watched it, documentary now on Netflix, it's The Great Hack. Now the thing that we know is that the way in which these techniques were trialed first and foremost at the very beginning kind of conflict areas, and then in elections in places like Nigeria and Kenya and many other beyond the continent. So the kind of like mischievous abilities and skills that were used later on and became very public in the United States and the UK were first trialed on African citizen and Vietnamese citizen and Trinidad and Tobago citizen. So in what some people call the peripheries. And then once those were learned, they were hitting hard at the core of politics. And this is really scary.
In your book, you mention that part of Huawei's success, linking to your point about the periphery now, you mentioned that part of Huawei's success in China depended on its ability to tap into unexploited and peripheral markets and grow progressively stronger from there. I have two questions. One of them is, you know, obviously today we might think about the African continent as one of said peripheral markets. How does this actually happen? I've heard the sentiment that China comes into African countries to execute projects which on the surface are good for development, but they primarily use Chinese companies. They don't engage in any meaningful knowledge transfer. Basically, again, like setting up beachheads in different countries or outposts in different countries without actually leaving too much of a positive impact beyond the infrastructure project itself. So,
like one of those sci-fi movies where like an alien race come and siphon, you know, the resources of another planet, that kind of thing.
Exactly. So my first question is, what do you think about, or what do you make of that? Or do you think that's an accurate way to describe the relationship? And the second is, given that this is exactly how Huawei played in China, and Huawei has been a key player across Africa, to what extent do you see Chinese companies as conduits or tools for the Chinese government or representatives, if you may?
No, this is a very interesting moment for Huawei and the like. I will try to answer in this way. And I wanted to write this book in 3 years, and it took me 10 years to write. So this is like goods and bads in that. And the good thing is that I could see that that relationship evolve over time. And it was incredibly interesting. So let me get back to Ethiopia, which is the country where I did most of my work and in this regard. So I remember when I first met with relatively young engineers working on for, at the time, the Ethiopian Telecommunication Corporation, then it became Ethio Telecom. So these young guys were quite forthcoming, and we had multiple chats and were saying, you know what, we are worried. We are worried because we don't have the password of the server that are used to run our own country. And all the kind of technical knowledge, at that time was ZTE, Huawei came later into the picture, is written in Chinese, and we don't speak Chinese. So the first answer, let's date it up to 2010, was yes, it's true. You know, China's coming with turnkey project. They don't want to transfer knowledge and so forth. But I want to make this point again about assertiveness. The moment in which some of the critical minds within Ethio Telecom realized that that was a problem, you know, the relationship changed. And first of all, the password were given away, and things changed in ways that more control was shifted back into the hands of Ethiopian engineers and so forth. And Huawei has been relatively responsive to this. So things have been changing, and this is an evolving space. So when Chinese company and the relationship with the Chinese government, this is a very complex, complex space. So on the one end, we have companies like ZTE. It's clearly a company where the state has a big stake. So in that case, the answer is quite straightforward. In the case of Huawei, things are much more complicated. And the fact that the founder used to be working, was to be a military person and working for the army is one of the things that is used very often to strengthen the point that there is a relationship. At the same time, Huawei has been able to provide services on a purely commercial basis and just winning bids that other couldn't stand a chance to win. Again, the relationship it's complicated because Huawei, as well as others, do have access to a set of preferential loans that are coming from the Chinese Exim Bank, that is the bank that is being used for development project. So clearly there is a ties there. But again, when it comes to like, are the data running through a Huawei built network going to go straight into the servers of the Chinese government? Well, to be honest, we don't have that much evidence on that. Actually, I'm going back to Edward Snowden. Because of what we now know, thanks to him, there were a couple of cases where the NSA had been installing backdoors in Huawei's routers, as well as routers produced by others. So at that point, one of my colleagues, I guess it was at King's College London, said, well, right now there is more available evidence that the American government used Huawei to spy on African citizens than the Chinese government did. I want to stress publicly available evidence. So maybe it's happening, maybe, but we just don't know. But the evidence that the government, the American government used it, that was there for people to look and assess by themselves.
Wow, the fascinating stuff. Also, Ruman, it just occurred to me as you asked the question about the perception about China sort of playing an extraction role on the continent. I wonder how they think of us collectively as the African continent and our interest in them. I wonder if this conversation were happening between two Chinese people and an area expert like Eugenio, how they would frame what they perceive Africa's interest is in China and to what extent it is a mutually beneficial proposition.
Seeing as I am not Chinese.
Last I checked.
But my impression is that China seems to view the African continent in two ways, as a way to, and this, you know, resonates with some things that Eugenio wrote in his book, that China might view Africa as a source of natural resources or raw materials, and also, again, extensions of its markets. So basically virgin markets where they can push products to test them, or to sell them, frankly, you know, for economic benefit. At the same time, you know, there's a bit of nuance here because I know that, lots of traders from Eastern Nigeria, they spend lots of time in China, trading with China. I've seen very anecdotal evidence of, you know, many Chinese people or Chinese traders learning how to speak Igbo in Nigerian language to communicate with Nigerians. And so while at the state level, I get the sense that this might be extractive. On the individual level, it seems to me like there's much more of a mutual respect.
How much of this is a like finding like, Eugenio? I mean, when you think of a company like Econet and the fact that it's, you know, crazy success is owed in great part to, you know, what has to be compromises struck with the Zimbabwean government. Or when you think about South Africa's Naspers, Naspers being Africa's biggest, you know, tech company and its direct link to dodgy beneficiation thanks to the apartheid government, which of course led to a much brighter and more productive future post-apartheid. When you think of, you know, some of the examples you've made in Ethiopia, or, you know, you can pretty much name all the biggest enterprise plays, homegrown enterprise plays on the African continent. And there's a very, very strong correlation between their success often and the relationship they have with, you know, the governments that, you know, basically regulate them. That sounds like China to me. So to what extent is China's success a situation of like working with like or finding more in common with like relative to, say, the global north? And to what extent is it maybe an approach thing where my perception is that China seems willing to come here and figure things out and learn relative to other players from other parts of the world?
Well, I have to say that China manages its own history. Just going back just to China for a minute, to strike a very interesting and very complex balance between state support and just letting things happen. So if you go back to the history of telecommunication and big companies in China, there was a period where Huawei was a very, very tiny company that didn't have a lot of support from the Chinese government at all. And as it happens often in tech, people will get a lot of funding from the state, not necessarily those who are going to succeed. And so going back, we're talking about 1990s when China was starting to try to liberalize. There were companies that were so closely tied to ministries. In that case, it was a kind of a competition across ministries. And it didn't work out. And Huawei sort of emerged as the victor in this very, very tight race. The moment that happened, the moment Huawei and ZTE, to a lesser extent, became the two very big global players, other companies decided just to be had enough of the Chinese market, which is like 1.4 billion people. So you have a lot of people to serve there. You don't necessarily have to go out. And at that point, they very much bet on it. So this answer, I can give you two different answers based on which period in history we're looking at. And in that case, you know, once Huawei emerges the victor, well, the government decided these are the guys we're going to invest into. And when it comes to trial and error in Africa, this is very interesting as well, because it seems that, and that was very much a perception of some of the African tech guys that I spoke with. It was, well, China is coming here with a lot of money and resources, and this is great, but there is so much that is just like, you know, they're going to try it. It's not going to work. They're going to fix it the next day. And then, you know, they're experimenting. You know, I'm going to use the word of one of the people I spoke with. They're experimenting on us. But then the other version of these, like, they're learning over time. So we are being experimented on. That was the feeling. But at the same time, things are eventually gonna get right. And in some cases it didn't work. In Ethiopia, now things are changing, but in the absence of monopoly, you have to make a phone call in Ethiopia. Now things are a bit better. But for a while, it was such a nightmare. And you just had to laugh. You know, you call your friend one day, the network doesn't work. That's what you hear by a voice that is kind of like English Chinese. And the next time you just dial the wrong number, which is not true because that's the same number over and over again. And the next day is just, you know what, a cell just fell to the ground. So, but that's the sense. That's the sense that, like, there have been a sort of commitment. They are experimenting, but they're here to stay. And there are pros and cons.
Anecdotally, one can point to Transsion, a company that came here as really nothing to, you know, to write home about, but sort of just dug their heels in and is now easily the biggest Africa-focused IPO success in China. I mean, so many oversimplifications in that very statement alone. However, quite interesting to see that isn't often the case for similar attempts to capture value on the African continent, whether they're backed by Europe or America, or at least when success does happen, it doesn't quite come in the same way. So it'll be something quite interesting to track. Again, this is not an exhaustive conversation we can have in a single show. This is definitely what we see as the start of starting to understand or creating a framework for understanding, you know, some of the nuances at play within this context. And perhaps to wind things down, I want to ask to what extent you perceive African nations as seeking to copy the quote unquote success, because I mean, depending on how you look at it, I mean, it's hard to argue it's not a success. The success of China's censorship of the internet, this ability of China to sort of do this double whammy of protecting its sovereignty and also sort of catalyzing technological innovation and limiting foreign interference, but also making an impact on global business. And it all seems linked to this decision to make things as close as possible. And I suppose, to what extent is that a model you've observed, even in places like Kenya and Ghana, which you've, by your definition, are more democratic or less closed? There must be some of those ideas that even places like that think, hey, we should borrow this or that.
Well, what you will get is very different if people are on the record or off the record. So if they are on the record, you know, China is seen, as you said, it's very much not a success when it comes to like the popular understanding. Of course, it's a success when it comes to like, you know, the boost of the economy and so forth. But the idea of like this very powerful censor space, it just doesn't fly with, I think, the vast majority of human beings. We just don't like that. And, but then when you go off the records, the things are very different. I remember this case. I was speaking in Ethiopia with one of the, let's say, ideologue of the Ethiopian government at the time. His name was Seba Nega. And it was very interesting that is conversation. It seems that all I do in my life is going on WikiLeaks. And but because of it, we now knew that there was a conversation between him and the American ambassador at the time, was Donald Yamamoto. And it was really interesting to hear Sebat Nega to tell to the American ambassador, wow, the Chinese model is what we need in this country. So just straight into the face. And that's what we would like to follow. And it was interesting. When I met Sebat, he was an old man at the time. And I told him that this conversation was in the public domain. And he had no idea. I don't think he spent a lot of time on WikiLeaks. But then when he spoke with me, he doubled it down. And he said, well, you know what? We really would like to follow the Chinese example, but it's just too complex. We will never master it. But definitely we want to learn something from it. Wow. So you have this kind of disconnect between what is being said and what is being done. And I think I would encourage other scholars to look into this gap, because I think that's where we will understand what the future of information societies in many African countries, but even globally, is going to be like.
We're going to need to have you back on the show to discuss this. This interplay that you've even started to allude to between promoting sovereignty, promoting securitization, this notion of a free but securitized internet. Yeah, it's just a fascinating thing. And to what extent it's already happening here on the African continent, and or something we might desire in part, rhetorically or otherwise. I think that's just such a fascinating conversation that we must have on another day. I thought it might be fun to just give you guys, you know, to throw stuff out there and get your sort of reflex responses, hot takes welcome to certain things that have been trending, and perhaps that we will we will explore in greater detail later on when we get the chance. Jack Ma is set to leave Alibaba. Good or bad for the Africa? Also, Ruman?
Neutral.
I didn't give that as an option, but I'll let that go. Good or bad for the Africa, Eugenio? Jack Ma about to leave Alibaba.
I think it's good.
Okay. China, or at least Chinese interests, circling Cell C, the beleaguered mobile telco in South Africa. Buying that asset would make them one of the top four, one of the top three mobile telcos in South Africa. Would that be good or bad for South Africa, or broadly for Africa? What do you think, Eugenio?
Can I say good and elaborate on that?
Okay, very briefly, go ahead.
Right, so because ZTE already has had a role in Cell C, and as many other Chinese companies did, for they worked for the Safaricom and for the Vodacom and so forth, but they never put their face into the market. So we know that some of the infrastructure is built by these countries, but they never got out there with their own brand names and saying, now we're going to provide services. So it would be fascinating to see how a Chinese company actually does into that space and be able to criticize for what doesn't work or appreciate what does work. But that would be a first, and I would be very interested in see what happens.
I don't know whether we should read into Vodacom hinting at the fact that mobile devices on their network will start to be locked, possibly going forward. Perhaps they're preempting a more China-led mobile telco environment in South Africa. Who knows?
Maybe.
It all remains to be seen. So, but let's move on to Transsion's IPO. I referenced earlier, Transsion's IPO in China, good or bad for us on the continent?
Definitely positive.
Awesome. What do you reckon, Eugenio?
Well, moderately positive. Mm-hmm. Do I have a minute?
Okay.
Because as you said earlier, and we discussed in very different shades, it's fantastic that companies like Technos and Transient are making values, are allowing people to afford a phone and be out there. But we probably heard of African-based mobile companies like Mara that was started first in Rwanda and is setting up shop in South Africa as well. So again, we had examples of strongly backed by governments. Paul Kagame was very instrumental in Mara, not succeeding. Was that probably the most famous one was like the European Union trying to develop a search engine that was better than Google. They poured billion of euros into that. Nobody ever, I don't even remember the name of it. So that doesn't mean that we have to as you guys said, and we agree, you know, there has to be a commercial reason why we buy a phone. It can't be just be like we buy it because it's an African phone. But I don't know, that space can be growth. And with Techno there, Mara, I think is going to struggle.
Interesting points you raised there. Moving on, over 60,000 African students being invited to study in China on their dime. Surely that can't be a bad thing. What do you think, Osaruman? Yes or no? Good for Africa or bad for Africa?
I think it's good.
Okay. Eugenio?
Straight good.
Straight good. All right. Well, what about finally, what seems to be China's warming to the idea of Bitcoin? Good or bad for Africa?
Can we leave it in?
Well, you might leave it at but can I just spice this up by saying it is quite telling that China has been for many, many years now, and you'll probably know this, Eugenio, backing the notion of moving the world over from its dependence on the US dollar to something perhaps a little more stable and less beleaguered by debt. So, yeah, in that context, I wonder what the strategy might be in suggesting that perhaps Bitcoin could be as good as its proponents suggest, coming from right at the top, mind you. And yeah, implications for Africa. Should we buy into this rhetoric? Yes or no? I'm going to force a hard yes or no from both of you.
Depends.
We need another show.
Okay, yeah. We'll leave it at that. I'll let you guys off the hook. And to be fair, you guys are both showing your class because, as we say here, oversimplification is the enemy. I'm forcing you guys into hot take pockets, which we don't typically do here on the show. But I think it's fantastic for teasing what should come later. And again, I need to emphasize, folks, we're not trying to exhaustively establish the state of play between the continent and China. Impossible to do on a single show. But I think what we have done successfully, no small thanks to you, Eugenio, being on the show, is to, you know, lay the groundwork, you know, set the table for what needs to come next, or indeed what we should discuss next. And so from that standpoint, we look forward to hearing back from you. What do you make of all the things we've raised? I mean, so much to dive into. We'll be sharing a ton of the resources we discussed in the show notes. Look out for that. If you want to do some more reading on your own, we'll certainly share links to Eugenio's new book. But yeah, please let us know what you make of this budding, I'd like to think, budding Africa-China relationship that is now leveraging very heavily happenings within the tech and innovation space. Please give us a shout on Instagram and Twitter at African Roundup, or drop us an email via our address, hello@africantechroundup.com, or simply follow us on Facebook. Yes, we're there too, folks. Facebook.com/African Tech Roundup. We'd love to hear from you. Love to hear what you think. Eugenio, where can people find your book, though? How do people get in, on board the Eugenio train?
The easiest ways to get it is the either the EPUB or the Kindle version. And if we want to bypass the big tech companies like Amazon, if you want to go straight to Zed Publisher, I wouldn't say it for any publisher, but Zed is a very interesting example. It's just a collective. There's no CEO, there is no boss. They're all at the same level. They publish very interesting stuff. So I would say, you know, if you want to give less money to Amazon and more to them, I think they deserve it.
I hear Edward Snowden is their CEO. In the back somewhere. No, I'm joking. No, that's really, folks, I'm really joking. I'm glad you shout them out. Support independent publishing. Cop his book. Will definitely show, you know, be links in the show notes. And of course, support the subtext always. Incredible long form essays. If you haven't had enough of Osaruman on this show, or really anywhere else you're lucky enough to hear him speak, you can definitely enjoy him in much greater length because he does a lot of his best writing for The Subtext. Check it out, thesubtext.io. And of course, anything else you want to catch up on the africantechroundup.com, we can't wait for you to get stuck in if you're just joining us for the first time, or even if you've been here a while, I'll bet you there's stuff you haven't heard. So head over there for all the best stuff. Otherwise, I have to thank you both. I'm going to start with you, Osaruman. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, my guy.
It's a pleasure, man. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you called it. You was like, it can't happen once. Well, at least you said you hope it doesn't happen once. We made sure it didn't happen once. Perhaps we might keep this going. Who knows? I'm certainly hopeful. Thank you so much. Eugenio Gagliardone. Did I say that at least half decent?
It was Gagliardone. I think you said it better at the beginning, but it's okay. Oh, Eugenio Gagliardone. I used my students saying it up. I know it's a complicated long surname.
Yeah. I suppose I'm just getting back at you for all the times my name's butchered. But no, I shouldn't do that at all. Thank you so much for being on the show, Eugenio Gagliardone. I certainly hope your book travels as far as it. I can't wait to get all the way through to the end of it. And I'm putting you on the spot by saying we will be hollering at you to have you back on the show. We plan to to do a lot more of these sort of Africa, China deep dives. And you're definitely one to tap when we do a future one. So I hope you don't mind us getting in touch then.
It was a fantastic pleasure. Really happy to be on the show. And whenever you guys feel it's a good time.
Fantastic. Well, guys, that's it. Thank you for listening to us as you've been rocking your baby to sleep, making your way through traffic, washing them dishes, whatever you've been doing listening to this podcast. Thank you for prioritizing this appointment and giving us an opportunity to share what's on our minds. And our village inspires us. And please keep it real by joining us again when we drop again. But for now, my name is Andile Masugu. Take it easy, Africa.